This is the second tape of the Diaconate Old Testament Home Temple Biblical Studies. Now, to put things into perspective, we can say that the event known as the Exodus, the time of Moses, when Moses takes the people out of Egypt, which seems to be historically very much different than the way it's portrayed in the Old Testament, maybe occurs around 1300 B.C. The actual historical event seems to have been a group of runaway slaves of the Hapiru, or Hebrews. There's no mention of a Moses. There's no mention of anything like this. It's just a rather minor event in the Egyptian chronicles. And at this period of time, the time of the wandering of the Hebrew people through the regions that it would eventually control, we have no real written histories. We know that some events happened. There were definitely wars and towns that were attacked, led by Jesus, Joshua, Yeshua, the protege of Moses. And we have some very interesting archaeological oddities. Schleimacher, who was the person who turned up the historical Troy in the last century, also excavated Jericho, a city that was perhaps 7,000 or 6,000 years old at the time that the Hebrews came from Egypt or escaped from Egypt. And normally these cities are built with walls. When they're invaded, the walls are broken in and they fall in because the invaders push the walls in and then they sack and pillage and rape and all that kind of stuff. And then people come back and rebuild the city on top of the rubble of the old city. And this is done over and over and over again until you have now in Palestine little grassy hills, or great large grassy hills of several acres, that are called tells, or small little hills, mounds. And these are the remains of ancient cities. And if you dig down vertically through these cities, you will be going down into a chronological record of the history of those cities and the destruction and the rebuilding and the destruction and rebuilding. And if we go as Schleimacher, who investigated very successfully and found the actual historical Troy, went to investigate the city of Jericho, and according to his records, at this period of time, historically, when we would have had the time of Joshua fit the battle of Jericho and so on, he finds that the walls of Jericho in that particular stratum fell outward rather than inward. And there is a miraculous story that's told that Joshua blows the trumpets and God assists him and the walls fall down. It could have been caused by an earthquake. The story of Joshua and Jericho may be an itological story. An itological story is a story that is created to explain an event. For example, people see this old oak tree that's split in half, and then they start to tell stories about it. And they say, well, a certain thing happened, and God struck it with lightning. And that people look at the tree, and they know the story. Well, of course, God didn't strike it with lightning, and that's why it is. It's just that the thing was existing there, and so people came up with an ideological story. And it may be that some amazing thing happened to the city of Jericho, perhaps an earthquake, and people later said that it was an amazing evidence of God's being on the side of Moses and other people that were attacking the cities at that time when they were wandering through that area. The same is probably true of the stories of Sodom and Gomorrah, which are today volcanic rubbish heaps. And perhaps that's where those stories came from, and the story of Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt and all this sort of thing. Maybe ideological stories that look at some kind of event and then come up with legends to explain them. In any case, it's clear that the Hebrews were there. There's a lot of archaeological evidence. They were there. They were involved in a lot of battles. They took down a more advanced and settled culture, and they were pretty wild, woolly warriors, and they took over the area. But then somebody else came in to that area after this. And this is during the period of what we call the Judges, when there is no king of Israel, and this period between 1300 and 1000 BCE. And these people are called in the Bible the Philistines, but we know them as the Phoenicians. They were people who had developed from the brass, the age of being able to make brass with copper and so on, into the age we know as the, from the Bronze Age into what we know as the Iron Age. And this happened up in the northern part of the Mediterranean, not in Egypt. Everybody in Egypt and China and everybody else was still making brass, and that meant all their swords and their shields and all their things were made of brass. Well, these people in the northern Mediterranean discovered how to make hotter fire. They discovered how to make bellows, and they discovered how to melt another rock, which we call iron. And they could melt that rock and make implements of war out of that, swords and shields, and those things were absolutely impermeable. You take a steel sword and you strike it against a bronze shield, and the bronze shield shatters. You strike a bronze sword against an iron sword, and the bronze sword shatters. And so these people, Phoenicians, for various reasons, they seem to have been driven out of their land by migrations of Celtic and other people. It's not clear. But they came in boatloads to Egypt, very small boatloads, maybe 50 in a boatload. We come to Egypt, which is this old, venerable, very developed culture that was in the Bronze Age. And these Iron Age people came across, and an army of 50 of them could wipe out an army of 500 Egyptians because they had superior weapons technology. They had iron weapons. And they came and settled the coasts, and they took all the good land. Because if you know the geography of Palestine, you know that the really good stuff is down in the lowlands near the ocean, and then you get up into the mountains where it's rocky and it's not fertile. And so they took all, they just came in and they just wiped everybody out, including the Hebrews, with their bronze weapons. And these are the people known as the Philistines, and they are represented symbolically in the Old Testament by the giant Philistine, Goliath. And David is represented as a hero because he takes his practically his non-weapon, which is a sling and a rock, and he goes into a battle with Goliath, a one-to-one battle in which he slings a rock at Goliath's at the center of his forehead and kills him with a stone. He makes himself very famous that way. These are probably not historical stories, because what is probably true is that the Philistines came in, or the Phoenicians came in, took all that territory that the Hebrews thought they had conquered and owned, drove them up into the mountains, and then under Saul, who became the first king, but who was apparently kind of an epileptic and kind of mad, kind of nuts, they started conducting, the Hebrews would conduct guerrilla raids against the Philistines, and they would, in during times of peace, trade with them in order to get the iron weapons, because they did not learn the secret of making Bronze Age weapons. So, Iron Age weapons. All they knew how to make was Bronze Age weapons. And so they had to trade with the enemy in order to get those weapons. And then they fought the enemy with the enemy's own weapons and eventually gained a lot of territory. And, of course, David was the great fighter who did that. Well, that period of time between the time of Moses and the time of King David, about 250-300 years, is the time of the Judges. And that is the time when there is not any literature, but there are proverbs, and there are stories of daring and battle stuff. The Song of Deborah, which is a short song of victory of a woman warrior, an Amazonian Hebrew woman warrior who wins battles. And some of the other stories, the stories we hear of Samson and Delilah and all that kind of stuff. And the literature starts to develop when we have an actual king, a King David, then his son Solomon. And they build a great empire, and they have access to weapons, they manage to finally drive the Philistines back, and they go to war against other countries nearby in their area, countries that are also in the Bronze Age, and they expand their borders and make Israel into a very serious nation. The Israelites, by the way, were known to the other nations as the Omri, not as the Israelites. And after David dies, Solomon brings it to its full glory. But after Solomon dies, that kingdom splits into two kingdoms, a northern kingdom known as Israel, and a southern kingdom known as Judah. And the holy city of Israel competes for the temple of God with the holy city of Judah, which is Jerusalem, and the city of David. And so there are two seats of God, two official holy temples of God, two kings of the Jewish people, and two ways of even addressing God. One is, as I mentioned before, Elohim, and the other is Yahweh. And so literature develops in both of those kingdoms, the northern and the southern, and we have the chronicles that are written, the chronicles, the stories of the kings, and we find them in the books of Kings and the Chronicles and Samuel and so on. And the Psalms are being written and passed down and used in temple worship. And there are all kinds of directions in the Psalms with funny words like Selah and so on that direct what kind of instruments are used and what people do and what their choreography is, etc. They're liturgical documents. And there are also the prophets then who are outside of the cities in the deserts, highly critical of what's going on with religion, of these people are not sticking to the true religion of Moses. They're the first thing they've done is the first really wrong thing they've done is they've made kings. They've made a king, and they should have no king but God. That's why the whole issue of the prophet Samuel putting his hands on Saul and making him a king, much against what he wants to do, is a big issue. And that whole idea of a religious authority installing a king becomes basic to all Western history. The Pope puts his hands on so-and-so and makes Charlemagne the king of the holy whatever empire and so on. So a tradition, by the way, that Napoleon breaks away from when he puts the crown on his own head very consciously and so on. And of course Charlemagne also grabs the crown with his own hands, and the hassle between church and state is clearly established. But we're 2,000 years later than we want to be right now with that little bit of digression. But going back to the prophetic versus the monarchic form of Hebrew religion, the two really don't meet. The prophets come in and criticize the kings. They criticize the rulers. They are in life and death struggles with people like Jezebel, who is the queen of Israel, and with her priests of Baal. And along comes Elijah, who does battle with the priests of Baal to convert the people back to the true religion of Moses, etc. And it's only in about the 600 B.C., 500 B.C., after, according to the prophets who have predicted this, Israel is wiped out by Assyria. And why? Because the Israelites did not follow the law, the religion of their fathers and their mothers. And that Judah goes through a big religious reform under Josiah with Hilkiah and so on. We call it the Deuteronomic Reform. And yet, even so, Jeremiah, the prophet, laments that there will be a captivity, that even Judah will eventually fall. And this is in a divine plan of God. And it's at this time that the wisdom thinkers are starting to be concerned about this issue, because the Deuteronomic Reform gives us the idea that if we just do follow God's laws, then God will reward us here on earth. And that leads to the idea that if people are wealthy and happy and healthy, then they're pleasing God. That's evidence that they please God, because God rewards people on earth. But if they're sick, and if they have bad luck, etc., then God is unhappy with them. And this idea obviously didn't play real well to anybody with any wisdom or any common sense, because he saw lots of good people who suffered and lots of evil people who had nothing but a good time. So this Deuteronomic idea that was sort of the confluence of prophetic and monarchic Hebrew religion was already troubling people. And after the time, and during the time of the exile, when the Jewish people who had reformed and done everything right and still got conquered and taken into exile, the whole question of why does the righteous person suffer? Why does the righteous man suffer? Became a real issue. Now we will find about 1000 BC stories that are like the Job story, Edomite stories, Edomite wisdom stories that are about the issue of why does the righteous person suffer. We find from that period of time, as the Egyptian Empire, as the Middle Kingdom begins to crumble under the onslaught of the Phoenicians and other kinds of historical and pressures that occur, we find that for the first time in 2,000 years, Egyptian society is crumbling and its values are crumbling, and we read some religious literature, wisdom literature, a dialogue of a man with his soul about whether there's any sense in even going on. The world is falling apart, etc. And here the questions are being raised in the wisdom tradition, in Egypt and Edom and many other places, and now in Israel. Why do the righteous suffer? How can God let people suffer who are good? And the answer comes in Hebrew religion in a great school of wise thinkers who produce a book we call the Book of Job. The Book of Job is an ongoing philosophical, theological, I wouldn't call it a dispute, it's a discussion. And it has roots back in Edomite, similar kinds of literature among the Edomites and among the Egyptians. We can find them and place them. But the Book of Job tells about a man who's a good man, who's doing everything right. And according to this, Satan, or who is known also as Lucifer, who is a member of the court of God, who is one of the sons of God, whose job is to be the chief prosecutor in the court of God, says, look at this righteous man, Job. Do you think he's really righteous? I bet, just let me have him in my power, and I bet that when he goes through a little trial and tribulation, we'll see what he's really made of. God says, okay, you can put him through all that, just don't take his life, but you can take everything else you want. And so he gets boils, and his children die, and everything goes, his life becomes a horrible mess. And all these wise men come to talk to him about why he's done this. And most of them are spouting the Deuteronomic idea. Well, you've sinned somewhere, some way you don't know about, you've sinned, and you have to make sacrifices to God, or make reparations, or make a sincere apology, or something like that. And Job says, no, I didn't sin. I never did anything wrong. And the whole discussion finally ends when God appears and says, you people are all wrong. He doesn't tell you what the answer is, but he says he restores all of the fortunes to Job and restores his children and brings them back to life and everything, and he lives happily again. So this story is a story that tells us that, yes, the good do suffer, and that it is in God's plan and for God's purposes. Well, of course, this is ancient literature, the idea of God as a king and Satan as a prosecuting attorney. But the basic idea still is that of testing, or tempting, to use the King James version of the word. To tempt is to test. That God makes us better by testing us, by allowing us to experience lots of bad and negative things so that we can become stronger and so that we can become more, have more integrity. Not all the time, but as one would make a strong metal. One has to temper the metal, one has to plunge it into the cold and then put it into the heat and so on. So human beings and human souls and human characters are forged in the retorts and the alchemical ovens of life. And this is the story of Job. This is a whole discourse, and the book of Job is actually a collection of over a century of Jewish philosophical and wisdom disputation, and we can demonstrate that with textual criticism. So that's another piece of literature that comes on the scene after the exile, and all the prophetic works are collected. The Psalms are organized. The Psalms are called the Psalms of David, but it's very clear that they appear that they're written over a period of several hundred years. That's because we have the process of pseudepigraphical literature. A pseudepigrapha, pseudo means false, epigrapha means name, false naming. You will find all kinds of such and such of Solomon, such and such of Enoch, thus the revelation of so-and-so, the Psalms of Solomon, etc. That is because in Jewish tradition, and also in a lot of ancient tradition, if a person was a disciple of another person, then that person was considered to be able to speak in his name. For example, a disciple of Paul wrote the epistle, perhaps to Titus. And it's called an epistle of Paul, but it's very clear Paul didn't write it. You can see, if you read any Greek at all, that the style is so radically different. It was not written by the real writer of the Pauline epistles. But it's called written by Paul because it's written by a disciple, close disciple of Paul. By the same token, if things are done in the spirit of, or people are channeling, you might say, the spirit of Solomon or the spirit of David, then as they were doing, for example, as the priests were doing when they created new psalms for the liturgies of the temple, then they were called the Psalms of David. But they were not necessarily all written by David. They could have been written by his successors and could have been written even hundreds of years later and be called a Psalm of David, because that whole stream is considered to have begun with David. And that, just like the stream of magic and wisdom, wisdom and magic is one aspect of the wisdom tradition of the fallen angels, etc., that Solomon represents in Israel. And so we have all the magic traditions and exorcism traditions are referred to Solomon. Pseudepigraphically, and so we have the such and such of Solomon. And then all the ascension traditions, the traditions of ascending into heaven, are attributed to Enoch. We have the secrets of Enoch, the apocalypse of Enoch, etc. So this literature develops after the return from exile from Babylon in the 5th century, 4th century. And finally, it's consolidated in the 1st century of the Christian era by the rabbis at Jamnia. And what's happened is about 3 centuries of literature is just left out. And they say the spirit of prophecy left Israel after the time of Daniel, because they don't want to admit that any of the stuff that came in the 2nd century or the 1st century was inspired, because it all points so clearly to Messianic Judaism. By the same token, when the Christians got together, their canon, they did so under the pressure of what was the beginning of what would be the Byzantine Empire. You see, Rome began to fall in the 2nd century, the 3rd century. By the 4th century, Rome was being invaded by the, quote, barbarians from the north. And the whole power of the Roman Empire was split among several generals, one of whom was Constantine. There were many cults and many religions in the Roman Empire, of which Christianity was one small cult. Constantine, the leader of a great army, according to the legend, saw a vision in the sky of what today we would call a cross. And he saw written on that the Latin words, "In this sign, conquer." And he took that as a sign that he would be victorious if he would take unto himself whatever religion that was. And he didn't know what religion it was. So he asked his generals and people to find out, what religion is it that has this cross? And they said, it's Christianity. He said, okay, then I want to become a Christian. And if I win the battles and I become the king of the new Roman Empire, that I will found it in the east, no longer in the west, but in the east, over in what today we call Turkey, then this religion will become the religion of the realm. And by gosh, that's exactly what happened. Constantine won, and so he made good on his promise, and he had become a Christian. Of course, he wasn't baptized till he died, and right before he died, because in those days, you wanted to be baptized without sin, and so, and you wanted to die without sin, and you could be baptized only once, and so the idea was you get baptized as close to the time you die as possible. That was the way the nobles did it in those days. But Constantine established the new religion as a religion of the land, and he brought together the bishops and from all the different cities, all the persecuted little churches all over the empire, and he said, you are now going to rule. But, so he said, what is your sacred book? And the people from Rome said, well, this is our sacred book. And he said, well, no, ours is a little different. Well, this is a little different over here in Alexandria. Well, in Antioch, we use this. He said, wait a minute. You guys have to get your act together if you're going to be the state religion now. I want you to decide what is actually in your holy book. And so they went through these councils to decide what was going to be in their holy book. And in this process, an awful lot of wonderful stuff was left out, and a lot of good stuff was brought in too and kept, and a lot of traditional stuff. It was a pretty good decision, but things that were traditionally part of what the Christians called the Bible, the New Testament, were dropped at that time. But much worse things happened than that, because these ecumenical councils also had to meet Constantine's demand that they have a consistent theology. And some of them were reincarnationalists, and some of them were not. And some of them believed theories of Arius, and some of them were Gnostics, and some of them were this, and some were that. And these, through these councils, eventually creeds were adopted and accepted, and the whole shape of this new state religion was pounded out in the smoke-filled room, so to speak. And these were not gatherings of wise saints. These were gatherings of people who were politicians, and they gave some and they took some, and they had to wheel and deal this way and that way. And the result of all these councils was what we call Christianity. One of the results was a text of the New Testament that is not a good text. It's called the Western Text. It's one of the least authentic texts of the New Testament. Scholars have had to, in the 20th century and the 19th century, have learned how bad that text was as we've dug up papyruses and other kinds of things and reconstructed a much better, more original text of the New Testament than we had there. All kinds of other ideas were brought into Christianity and made standard ideas that were actually only ideas in some of the churches, and other things were dropped. And so what we know as medieval Christianity was formed in this environment. And as a result, many churches dropped away and became heretical churches, the Monophysite churches, the Nestorian churches, the Arian churches, all kinds of other groups. And the Byzantine church triumphed politically and carried on in the new city of Constantine, Constantinople, which is now called Istanbul, where great Saint Sophia, once the great cathedral of Byzantine Christianity, is now a great mosque, because the Muslims conquered the area after the first millennium. And so as a result of these not very elegant processes, the Christian canon of Bible and Scripture was established. So that's where the Bible came from. Our Bible is full of a lot of compromise. It's got a lot of technical difficulties. It's got a lot of textual variance. One place in the Apocalypse of John that says, if anyone tampers with this text and removes anything from it, then his part in the life of the New Jerusalem will be taken away from him. And if he adds to these words, all the torments will be added to him, etc. That very phrase appears in something like 10 variants in the text. So the textual integrity of the Old Testament and the New Testament is another entirely different issue than just how it came to be, where it came from, and what it's composed of. And I want to talk to you about that on the other half of this tape. So, please let the tape wind to the end and turn it over and start it from the other side. Thank you.